Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
GOP operatives take the stand to answer accusations they tried to influence congressional map drawing in Florida.
I believe I was seeking technical assistance when I sent that to him.
You remember that? That's one of the things you do remember in this case?
The times that I contacted him, it was about technical assistance. That's my recollection.
Also tonight, the search for a new university president for FSU has some suggesting the process may not be totally transparent.
Circling the wagons, trying to protect and control the release of information, it doesn't work. Sunshine is the best antiseptic.
We'll also hear how a U.S. Supreme Court ruling will impact some Florida death row inmates, visit a new school for oyster harvesters, and watch some college-age lawmakers in action. I'm Tom Flanagan, and welcome to Capitol Report. As voting rights groups wrapped up their case in Florida's redistricting trial this week, a picture emerged of GOP operatives working behind the scenes to get their maps submitted to the legislature. As Jessica Palumbo reports, questions centered on exactly how a Republican-generated map got submitted under the name of an FSU student.
The big question Circuit Judge Terry Lewis must answer is, did the Florida legislature comply with the state's Fair Districts amendments when they drew new congressional districts? The amendments are twofold. They say lawmakers must draw compact districts, and they must not intend to favor a party or incumbent. Judge Lewis says he's weighing both parts.
You can have all the best intent in the world and draw a crazy map that doesn't comply with the constitutional mandate.
Voting rights groups backed by the Florida Democratic Party are attempting to prove Republican lawmakers erred on both compactness and intent. First, compactness. Stanford University political scientist Jonathan Roden testified his computer simulations of Florida's maps produced more compact districts than the legislature's again and again.
The most recent report with 1,000 simulations in it, each of those simulations is more compact than the legislature's plan.
Roden says while the Constitution prohibits partisan considerations, it also gives the job of map drawing to whichever party happens to be running the legislature. So he says the only way to have 100% politically blind districts is to let computers draw them. As former House Speaker Dean Cannon pointed out on the stand, after the Fair Districts amendments passed, partisan habits were hard to break for political strategists who'd always been allowed input.
I think all the political consultants, Republican and Democrat, desperately wanted to be involved in the process. And I wanted to figure out what was and was not permissible because I was responsible both constitutionally and I felt a personal obligation to oversee the process in the House.
But plaintiffs' lawyers argue consultants found ways to stay involved. They presented evidence that legislative leaders remained in contact with GOP consultants who drew maps throughout the process, and that one of those maps drawn by Florida Republican Party official Frank Terraferma was the basis for the congressional map that passed. In an email, Terraferma seems to be telling GOP consultant Rich Heffley he was having trouble submitting maps through the legislature's public website. Attorney David King asked Heffley about that email.
Aren't you being asked the question by Mr. Terraferma, who's been supporting your efforts, as to whether he should try to get this map resubmitted again in the public portal after it bounced back?
Sure looks that way.
Well, it does. And your response was, might as well submit. The worst they can do is not take it. Right?
Correct.
Heffley admits to sharing maps with others in the consultant community and encouraging people to submit them, but he says he doesn't know who submitted a key map under the name of FSU student Alex Posada.
And you don't know who among your group had anything to do with that. Is that right?
Not specifically, no.
Specifics were also sketchy in Terraferma's mind. He testified he drew and shared maps with Heffley and others, but his memory seemed hazy after that.
Is it your testimony, sir, that you never, ever asked Mr. Heffley What are you doing with my maps?
I just don't recall a conversation where I asked him that or where he told me that. I mean, but certainly it seems like, you know, we were sharing the maps and that they might be publicly submitted.
When Heffley was asked why draw maps at all if operatives aren't legally allowed input on redistricting, Heffley said as a Senate campaign consultant, he would have been interested in congressional maps too to see how they would affect state district boundaries. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
That redistricting trial isn't the only source of buzz in the Florida Capitol nowadays. As Florida State University continues its search for a new president, many of the school's faculty and other observers are crying foul over the selection process. Lynn Hatter reports the frontrunner for the job is a powerful political figure who even admits his academic credentials aren't spectacular. That has a number of critics crying that the search process would appear to be rigged in his favor.
Florida State University's faculty have been some of the most vocal critics against the school's presidential search. Faculty Union President Jennifer Proffitt says the search committee agreed on getting a president with strong academic credentials, but it's not panning out that way.
You know, search committees or search firms set deadlines so that people know when they can apply by, and that wasn't done. And the criteria that the search committee had voted on in April was not followed.
There's no deadline for FSU's search. Strong academic credentials don't appear on the job advertisement, and that item is listed among the other qualifications. Leadership, legislative experience, and fundraising, even university loyalty, are rated higher, leading to allegations the search has been rigged to favor just one candidate, State Senator John Thrasher.
That's a tough question. I think that there have been signs, evidence all along that something was happening. So we've known from the beginning that, you know, that Senator Thrasher was interested in the position. And again, it's not about him. It's about the process.
When the search committee named Thrasher its sole interviewee, about 10 applications had already been submitted, including high-level administrators at the University of North Texas and the respected Oak Ridge National Research Laboratory. There's also a former CEO of the Washington Post Company. The consultant hired to recruit candidates, Bill Funk, has said the prospect of Thrasher's candidacy has kept other well-qualified applicants from submitting.
And again, many things have been written about him. That's been the seems to be the topic of discussion both locally and even nationally. So it's not as though, as a public figure, he's unknown.
Well, it's almost looking like a done deal.
The First Amendment Foundation's Barbara Peterson says FSU has conducted the search in the open and in compliance with the state's open government sunshine law. She says just because the process has been open does not necessarily mean it's been fair. And she points to the search committee's vote to interview Thrasher, who hadn't applied for the job at the time.
Claiming that no one else will apply because this person is considered so much of a shoe-in that they don't want to apply. I see it really as a subversion of the process.
The presidential search is the latest in a series of high-profile issues at Florida State University in the past 6 months. The school is still facing blowback for its handling of sexual assault allegations against its star quarterback and a failed push led by Senator Thrasher to split the FAMU-FSU College of Engineering.
Their integrity is being called into question. And what they should have learned is that, you know, circling the wagons, trying to protect and control the release of information, it doesn't work.
But Alan Bentz, chairman of Florida State University's Board of Trustees, says he disagrees with that characterization.
Clearly, I don't think there is. I think, number one, we have the number one football team in the country. So we've got a little bit of a target, a bullseye on our back. The FSU engineering issue is, I don't understand how that can draw attention to our integrity. I don't get that. We just want to be, frankly, and we want to be one of the top 25 universities in America.
And Bent says the university's search committee is in a catch-22 when it comes to what to do with Thrasher.
Help me a little bit. How do we get over that? I mean, you tell me how we get through that. I'm not being feisty. I'm just saying, I don't know how to get through that.
Bentz says just because Thrasher has an interview does not mean he'll get the job. He points to the recent hiring of Florida Atlantic University's new president, who beat out two state politicians for the gig, former U.S. Senator George Lemieux and state chief financial officer Jeff Atwater.
I can tell you, if the president of Harvard University says, I'm going to apply at FSU, you can rest assured, Len, that will get my attention. I mean, that's an A player. I'm exaggerating, but the door's wide open. But the problem is, and again, help me if you have a better idea, as long as the perception is out there that it's Senator Thrasher's, the pool of talent to be the next president is going to be thin, you know?
Thrasher will be interviewed at FSU on June 11th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a Supreme Court ruling says Florida's method for determining whether someone is eligible for the death penalty violates the Constitution. Now experts are wondering how that will extend to similar cases around the country.
If the court is committed to making sure that states don't circumvent its Atkins ruling, then at some point it's going to have to look at some of these other issues.
We'll hear from the outgoing head of Florida's Juvenile Justice Agency, who's planning to retire next month. We'll see a new training ground for what could be a new generation of oyster harvesters in Florida. And Florida lawmakers were back in Tallahassee this week, although these lawmakers weren't the same ones who fled the Capitol 4 weeks ago. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling will change the way Florida evaluates whether a death row inmate should be exempt from execution. Regan McCarthy reports Florida is one of a handful of states that bases the decision for execution on whether an inmate is intellectually disabled and therefore ineligible for being put to death on a hard-line test score.
Years ago, Florida officials declared death row inmate Freddie Hall intellectually disabled. Then, in 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Atkins v. Virginia that executing a mentally disabled person violates a constitutional amendment banning cruel and unusual punishment.
They did so for two reasons, and they made clear that each of these reasons would be sufficient. The first was that a substantial number of states had recently passed laws making clear that it was illegal in their state to execute someone with mental retardation. There were 18 such states, one of which was Florida, where the legislature had passed a statute.
That's University of New Mexico law professor James Ellis. He argued before the court in the Atkins case. Ellis says the court also felt a mentally disabled person has less ability to help their lawyers prove their innocence. But that ruling didn't help Freddie Hall. The U.S. Supreme Court left it up to the states to decide whether a person is intellectually disabled, legally referred to as mentally retarded. Florida defined that as anyone who scored above a 70 on an IQ test. Hall scored a 71. Florida officials said that was enough to make him eligible for the death penalty. But his lawyer, Seth Waxman, says drawing such a hard line is unfair.
Because of the standard error of measurement that's inherent in IQ tests, it is universally accepted that persons with obtained scores of 71 to 75 can and often do have mental retardation.
Hall's score fell within that margin of error, and Waxman brought the case to the U.S. Supreme Court and argued in Hall versus Florida that Florida officials are essentially circumventing the court's Atkins ruling. And in an opinion handed down Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. Ellis says it's good news for Hall and other inmates facing the same situation.
Whether it's hostility to that rule or whether it was merely a search for sort of administrative convenience, in either event, the Supreme Court's ruling makes clear that the court of a state cannot adopt an arbitrary rule that excludes claimants who have legitimate evidence of their disability.
The ruling means Hall will have the opportunity to present new evidence of his disability, and experts expect it will be enough to make him ineligible for the death penalty. It also means four other states that hadn't considered the margin of error for their determinations will have to change their practices. But Cornell Law School professor John Bloom says it's not clear yet how much farther the reach of that court's ruling could extend.
Whether the court meant what it said when it said that we're not going to allow states to circumvent our decision in Atkins, because Hall is emblematic of one thing states have done that are inconsistent with the clear clinical consensus, but other states, you know, other than Florida, have done other things on the other prongs, and you know what the future of those of the litigation involving those will be, I think, is too early to tell.
There are three prongs states use to determine someone's death penalty eligibility. The first is the IQ test. After that, officials also consider a person's adaptive functioning, or ability to carry out everyday activities, as well as when the disability arose. Hall had been stopped at the first prong, but after the court's ruling, we'll get a chance to present evidence along prongs 2 and 3. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
In a month, Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters will be retiring from her role. As the agency's first female head, she's also one of the longest-serving agency heads under Governor Rick Scott. She's been responsible for a number of innovations, including a civil citation program that has helped reduce the overall juvenile crime rate. Sasha Cordner recently sat down with the outgoing secretary to talk about her stepping down from her role and what might lie ahead for her.
I'm speaking with current Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters. So welcome to our Capitol Report program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the reason why we're here is you're leaving the agency soon on June 30th to retire. Talk a little bit about that and what made you come to this decision.
Well, I think I would rather call it a timeout instead of a retirement. But it's been a very intensive 3.5 years. All of the major goals have been accomplished. We have a lot of things in the works, and when we pass the bill, it's time to take a break.
How would you say the department fared in the 2014 legislative session, and did all your priorities get through?
We have been working for about 3 years to position us to update the statutes that govern the juvenile justice system. We initially drafted a roadmap to systems excellence, took it around the state as a draft, and asked people to provide us with input. And we were able to put an initial bill together for the section of the statutes 985 that really reflect what we've been doing to make this a better system. And I don't even think it's the end of the reforms or the end of the updating of the laws. I think it really represents the beginning, because we now have people thinking about taking it to additional levels and looking at different other parts of the system that maybe didn't make it into the first draft. And as far as the legislature is concerned, they were very generous with our department in giving us additional funding and enhancing the programs that are in the front end of our system. So it was a really, really good year for us.
Now, before you were tapped by the governor, you worked as the head of Miami-Dade's Juvenile Services Department. So what's made you passionate about working for the juvenile justice system all these years?
Well, when I was growing up, I was just in trouble all the time. And I never quite understood how I was constantly getting into trouble. And I think that there are thousands of kids who find their way into the juvenile justice system that ask that same question. So I feel compassion for children, because so often they just have no idea. They make some foolish choices and show some poor judgment, but my gosh, they're children. So we have to have a system that is going to protect their best interest. And protecting their best interest is not treating them so cruelly that we make them more angry and more unlikely to fit in. We can't interrupt their education. We need to ensure that they're getting a good education. And we need to, if they're angry or if they're upset or they're acting out, we need to teach them a better way, how to deal with those issues and how to act in a way that is going to allow them to have a good future.
And what is something that you feel very proud of? Just kind of expound on a few things that you feel is a focus and was a focus during your tenure. And one of the things that I'm sure you're going to talk about is civil citations. Whenever I think about you, that's probably the thing that comes to mind the most, and that some say help bring down the overall juvenile crime rate.
Well, you couldn't say anything that makes me happier to hear that. Certainly civil citations is playing a role in that. And a civil citation is not a parking ticket. It is basically just a term that's used for a child that's going into a diversion program for a first-time misdemeanor. It's very accountable. It's got some requirements, and the child who has committed that misdemeanor has some responsibilities that they have to adhere to. But what it does is it allows us to really check on whether that child has got some issues that we can address right up front. And if they are successful in doing everything that's required of them, then we do not put their arrest record into the criminal justice database, which is going to be instrumental for those kids to be able to get a job, get school loans, get admitted into schools. So that's playing a big role, and I think our whole department is really proud of that.
On next week's Capitol Report, in part two of her interview, Sasha asks outgoing Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters about her plans after she leaves office at the end of June. Next week, Governor Rick Scott will have the final say on the nearly $80 billion state budget passed by the legislature earlier this month. Now, $250,000 doesn't seem like much in the midst of that veritable ocean of spending, but as Ryan Bank reports, officials at one particular environmental school have their fingers crossed, hoping the governor approves their relatively minuscule appropriation. Those officials say that small investment could help save a $71 million Florida industry.
But here, the oyster cages that were, this is only a small part of the oyster cages.
Bob Ballard carefully swings open the door to a large room and flips on the light switch. Half of the area's space is taken up by thousands of cylindrical oyster cages, stacked past the room's large windows and touching the ceiling. Ballard is the executive director for Tallahassee Community College's Wakulla Environmental Institute. The institute is currently sharing space with a bank in Crawfordville, but is in the process of breaking ground on a new state-of-the-art facility, only the first building of what eventually will become its own thriving college campus. One of the institute's most anticipated programs is an oyster cultivation school.
We plan on growing 1 million oysters with this class of 10 each.
Just this class?
Just this class. And each student will harvest about 100,000 oysters if everything goes to plan.
Officials from the fledgling environmental school are hoping an additional $250,000 in state cash appropriated last legislative session can help expand the program, which has technically been functioning since last January. Ballard says oyster aquaculture, growing and harvesting oysters using cages in rows, similar to how crops are harvested on land, has the potential to help struggling oystermen keep their heads above water.
They will be able to, after they pay us back for the investment that we put in them, essentially the equipment, cages and line and whatnot, and oysters, and actually we pay for the lease. Once they pay that back, everything else is theirs. And
Ballard describes the Oyster Vocational School as an interest-free loan and sustainable education program. Students who are accepted pay nothing up front other than their time and effort. By year's close, they should make between $40,000 and $60,000 after their oyster crop makes it to market. After paying back the initial $20,000 investment, the student keeps what's left over. But not everyone in the seafood industry is so convinced of the program's usefulness.
The farming issue is something that seafood workers does not favor at all.
Shannon Hartsfield is the president of the Franklin County Seafood Workers Association, an advocacy group for commercial fishing interests in and around Apalachicola. He thinks Ballard's vision is a bit of wishful thinking. From his experience, he says the program will probably be more costly and yield less profit for oystermen than if they just continued to fish for wild oysters in the bay.
You have to sit there and wait 9 months before you could sell any oysters, okay, on an acre of oyster. And the most you're going to get is, if you do get a good turnout, is 500 bags.
Hartsfield says trying to convert traditional oyster harvesting to a farm-like system doesn't really get to the root of the problems in the bay and with the oyster industry as a whole. He also thinks the people who benefit most from programs like it aren't the fishermen, rather the school itself. Still, Bob Ballard admits the program isn't meant to replace the harvest of wild oysters, but is simply to be used as a supplement for fishermen and an opportunity to learn other means of extending the industry's life. The governor is expected to approve the legislature's $250,000 appropriation for the program. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Finally this week, the Florida legislature was back in session today. It just wasn't the legislature most Floridians are familiar with. As Katie Swatowski reports, the Florida model legislature came to argue bills, just like real senators and representatives who sat in the same chambers only weeks before.
While the real 2014 legislative session recently came to a close, college students from all over the state came to Tallahassee this past week to participate in a simulated session of their own. The program, known as the Florida Model Legislature, has been convening since May 28th and will continue through 9 p.m. Friday night. Doug Ryan is the program's executive director.
The Florida Model Legislature is a program where students who want to develop a further interest in state and local legislative issues and political matters and public service matters for the citizens can take an in-depth look at the process and how an idea becomes a law and how an idea becomes a law that then benefits the people.
The simulation splits participants into two political parties, as well as senators and House representatives. This year, the Unity Party represented the Democratic side of politics, and the Liberty Party represented the Republican stance. Each participant writes his or her own piece of legislation that they are then responsible for in committees. In addition, a governor is elected to run the executive branch, which, in this case, the governor is the executive branch. Representing Miami-Dade College North Campus for the House is Representative Natalie Cabo of the Unity Party.
I never really considered like politics something I would want to do in the future, but after attending this and learning so much about it, it's really opened up my eyes to, it has given me like a lot of passion to want to do something in my community and to make a difference here in Florida.
College students interested in the state can research the Florida Model Legislature further by looking at their website. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Katie Swatowski.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Other reporters this week are Ryan Bank and Katie Swatowski. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.